This week on the show, we covered the FreeBSD's foundation statement on the European Union Cyber Resiliency Act, a Dragonfly BSD on a ThinkPad T480S tutorial and experience report, how FreeBSD employs Ampere ARM64 servers in the data center, FreeBSD YubiKey authentication tutorial and everything you need to know to make that work on your FreeBSD system, the time that the HTOP author almost added Tetris to it, and more in this week's episode of BSD Now. BSD Now, episode 549, HTOP Tetris, recorded on the 21st and a half of February 2024. This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDnow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDnow. And we thank you in advance for that. Hi, I'm your host, Benedikt Reuschling.
And I'm Jason Tubner,
who's always reporting from the future. And that's why we have the 21st and a half as the date.
Only slightly in the future now. It's later there where you are, and it's later here too. So, wow.
Yeah.
What was it? That's 7:18 a.m. here local time.
Oh, okay. So. Yeah. Just the possibility of being able to do this is just mind-blowing, as the content for this episode as well. But as the beginning, let me tell you a little story before we start. So, I have been with a Nextcloud hoster for 10 years or so, right? So I paid them a bunch of money at the beginning, and then I got an unlimited space account, never had to pay any more money. And occasionally it was down because they migrated to a bigger instance, and then it resynced and everything was fine. So last week, Friday, I was like, the sync is not working. Are they just replacing disks again, or what's happening? And that has been going on since Monday. So I was like, yeah, that's a bit long wait maintenance window. So I go to their website to check if there's a support ticket or anything. I log in and I found the message that they're going out of business.
Oh, no.
And when are they going out of business? On Saturday, tomorrow. And with kind of like a message was like, you have all your Nextcloud data anyway, because you're of course syncing it with your local machines, and we're off. Thank you. Goodbye. And yeah, we have all the data on our local machine, unless you have not synced everything. So I have a couple of things that I don't want to have on every machine, so I unticked those boxes for those directories, and that is now gone. This part I could never retrieve again.
So they didn't send out a warning letter to say,
nothing.
Hey, we're going out
no
of business.
No email, though. Hey, please back up your files or go to another hoster or something. We're shutting down services everywhere. And I mean, Alan has been mentioning this for a number of years, like, yeah, that these Nextcloud providers only live so long, especially when you pay money for them. They cannot keep a stable operation for a number of years. But this has been going on for like 10 years. And I was like, that's fine for me. I paid a little bit of money. It was actually like 200 euros back then for the initial service, but it was lifetime. They never asked me for money again. I could create tickets if I had problems. That was all fine. And after like 10 years, they just cease operations from like one day to the next.
Yeah, it sounds like some parent companies come in and shut the service down or they've run out of money. I mean, you know.
Probably, yeah.
When you look at how much you pay, that's 20 euros a year. So, that's still acceptable, but they mustn't have had a sustainable business model for what they needed. So
now I'm in a desperate need of a new synchronization service for my, you know, calendar events and files and my digital life, basically. I have it all locally, of course, my most important data. And of course, most stuff is in Tarsnap as well. But for calendar syncs that I already get, there's no valid certificate anymore. And where's the hoster now and stuff? So I need to probably set up my own Nextcloud instance. And I have a bunch of good tutorials found already on the web. Vermadin, for example, has created one on his blog for FreeBSD 13. But if any of you has like the perfect Nextcloud setup on a BSD preferably, then why not send this to feedback@bsdnow.tv and I will be a very happy man implementing that.
You could just ask me. I've got one sitting beside me.
Right?
Yeah. Now, I was in the same situation as you, Benedict, that I was stuck in the, you know, everything was scattered everywhere. You had, you know, iCloud on the iPhone and then you needed somewhere on your desktop calendar and that sort of stuff. So I moved the Thunderbird quite some time ago and I go, well, you know, Nextcloud supports the, you know, iCal integration, that sort of stuff. So
that was fine. Yeah,
yep. So I stood that up. It's running in a Beehive jail with Angie, which is a fork of Nginx. So
everybody
just goes Nginx was just forked last week. No, Nginx was forked like 2 years ago by X developers, and it was called Angie. I think it might be pronounced as like Engie, the power company.
I even have colleagues that say not Nginx, but Nginx. they kind of break their tongue every time. And I'm like, go to the website, go to Wikipedia, and there you will see how it's pronounced, right?
Yeah. So I got a working config there, and then that banks onto the Nextcloud backend. So I have the synchronization for calendar, I think it is, and contacts that I use.
Yeah. That's my main thing. I live in calendar and contacts, mostly in calendar.
Yeah.
And of course, we have at the university, we have a Microsoft Exchange thingy there, but I don't want to sync my private stuff into it.
That's just the same for me. I've got that access at work as well, but I don't want that.
I have separate accounts. Yeah.
Yeah. Though I find the mail component of Nextcloud is actually, it's got a lot of work to do.
I've never used that.
It's good for just browsing mail, but sometimes you'll just get like, it'll just die and you just don't know why. And you've got to restart the Redis engine in the back end and that sort of stuff. It's just the most clunkiest part of the whole experience. Like everything else just works super smooth, but the mail plugin is just absolute rubbish. And
Lucas finishes his book. Then we'll all be doing our own mail servers in no time.
Well, I run my own mail server as well, so that's what I want to integrate with that, because then I've got my mail on my phone and then the mail in Nextcloud. So I've got two ways of getting at it if I'm not at home with Thunderbird. So, if they can fix that, I don't want to go and have to spin up Roundcube or anything like that to do webmail. Yeah. So I'd really like them to fix that particular issue, and I don't want to run my Nextcloud instance in developer mode. So
I also didn't use many of the other Nextcloud services like Picture Sync or what else do they have? I was mostly just, I want my messages in my calendar. I want my contacts synced everywhere on mobile phone and everywhere I go. And that's pretty much it. I also want the file sync in the background that I have it everywhere I go. And so I did go into full all of their features that they provided. I was fine with what they provided me in the beginning. And I mean, we are the people who can eat our own dog food. We will be running these services on BSD. We would know these things, how to update them, how to keep them running, how to synchronize them, how to back them up. And it's just another way of synchronizing, or not synchronizing, but eating our own dog food. And you know, being the person responsible for making the digital life that we all have work, right?
Mm. Yeah, because,
and not provided to some external partner who goes out of business all of a sudden.
Yeah, you know, other people, you know, look to you know, people inside projects to, you know, make sure that things work correctly, because at the end of the day, there's going to be a bug report that comes in from someone. So if we can cut it off the chase and get particular problems fixed. I know, you know, the Beehive users forum and that sort of stuff really goes into this, and we see bugs that come through the Beehive mailing list, and it's, you know, where, you know, niche parts of, like, you know, there's a current bug in Anaconda when using NVMe subsystem where it triggers just Anaconda to fall over when you're doing like a Alma Linux or Rocky Linux, Red Hat Enterprise Linux install from 9.2 onwards. There was some regression that's there, but we can't sort of nail it down. And it only happens when you're using, NVMe-backed image files and not NVMe-backed Zvol files. So it's just like, it's really weird edge case and that sort of stuff. But you do get questions about that and using, dog fooding, that sort of stuff. That's why I've got Nextcloud running in FreeBSD in a beehive on FreeBSD. So, you're testing all those layers out to make sure that
each particular instance.
No breakage.
And of course, you have to be responsible for updates and backing up and monitoring. It's a lot of extra work that you have to do, but you're in control, right? When you update, when you get the next disk upgrade or whatever, you're in control and not give it to someone else who takes care of it for you for a bunch of money.
Yeah, and no idea when they go out of business.
Yeah, especially when it's so sudden and without much noticing time to, back it up everywhere, somewhere else. Anyway, that's our little rant at the beginning. Let's dive into the beginning headlines. And this is also important for a lot of people because this is about the European Union's Cyber Resiliency Act, and the FreeBSD Foundation has written a statement about that. Which reads from February 8, 2024, that is, the FreeBSD community recognizes the importance of cybersecurity measures to safeguard digital infrastructure and protect user data. This is why we have been a leader in security by design for 30 years and why many leading security vendors base their solutions on FreeBSD. The European Union Cyber Resiliency Act, or CRA, represents a watershed in government regulation of cyber resilience across the EU. Open source communities, including the FreeBSD Foundation, initially expressed concern that the CRA could subject open source projects, communities, and developers to the same security procedures and potential fines as commercial entities. The FreeBSD Foundation gratefully acknowledges the efforts made during the legislative process to raise and address these concerns and welcomes the revisions made in the final version of the CRA. The final version improves important exclusions of open source projects, communities, foundations, and their development and packages or package distribution platforms. The FreeBSD Foundation supports initiatives to promote cybersecurity standards and best practices while preserving the principles of openness, transparency, and collaboration, foundational to the open source community. We commend the European Union for engaging with open source stakeholders and taking steps to ensure that CRA strikes an appropriate balance between enhancing cybersecurity and supporting open source innovation. The FreeBSD Foundation will continue contributing to the ongoing cybersecurity dialogue and collaborate with policymakers, developers, users, and industry to address emerging threats. We do so through active participation in the Open Policy Alliance, that is a link to their website, and active and ongoing engagement with security researchers and entrepreneurs building the FreeBSD or with FreeBSD and collaborating closely with open source security professionals. We believe that through continued engagement and cooperation, we can collectively build a more secure and resilient digital ecosystem for all. And they provided two extra steps for resources about the CRA and what that means for open source. And if you're interested in this kind of policy initiative and the final act or the law that has put into place, you can find them on these links that were provided.
Next up in the headlines, Tom's not going to like this one. Tom doesn't like Dragonfly. But anyway.
Oh, well, like is a strong word, or not like.
Yeah. So this one's for you, Tom. It's a blog post of Dragonfly BSD on a ThinkPad T480S. I took some time off work at the end of December and decided to play around with Dragonfly BSD, a really interesting OS. I really like the simplicity of the family of BSD operating systems. For a while, I ran OpenBSD as daily driver on a number of different laptops. OpenBSD is a great OS, but it is not very performant, nor is performance something the OpenBSD team prioritizes, which led me to Dragonfly BSD, the snappiest, most performant BSD of the bunch. Initial installation. Download the USB image from the Dragonfly BSD website. I was able to use UEFI and follow the defaults on the installation process. One thing I did do was add my user to the wheel and video groups which you need to do for sudo and X respectively. Dragonfly BSD does not come with Xorg installed, so your initial boot, you'll just get a bash shell prompt and the good old Vi as your editor. Install packages. Like most of the BSDs, Dragonfly BSD comes with a minimal but thoughtful set of initial programs. So you'll want to start by copying the sample repository config to start installing basic packages. So it's got some commands here, cp for the df latest sample, it's just to set the repos up. And then there's install a few useful programs to make life easier, package upgrade, package update, that just sets up the package metadata ready to go. And then package install bash, vim, sudo, curl, hexchat, firefox, and keypassxc. I had to remove the /user/local/bin/openssl at the setup due to conflicts with libreSSL. Wi-Fi. My router is in a cold, unfinished basement, so one of the first things I did was set up Wi-Fi, which was a breeze. Most of the section below is shamelessly lifted from the Dragonfly BSD website. It's got a link to the component of the website. The wireless device on the T480 is identified as IWM0. Add the IWM drivers to /boot/loader.conf. And this example of all the IWM drivers being loaded from the loader. The version of WPA supplicant that comes with Dragonfly BSD is old, so it's a good idea to install the newer version from packages. PKG install WPA_supplicant. Next, set up the WPA supplicant by configuring it in /etc/rc.conf. So a configuration for WPA supplicant program, so it doesn't use the one that's in base, uses the one for ports, as defined in rc.conf. Open /etc/wpa_supplicant.conf. Replace my SSID and my PSK with your own SSID and private share key. If the file doesn't exist, create it. So we've got a configuration there, just an example. And then add entries to /etc/rc.conf to configure the network on setup. So WLANs IL0 equals WLAN0, and then define WLAN0 with WPA DHCP. Reboot to get the Wi-Fi drivers and test your connection. Next is enable sudo. So he's just uncommented the percent wheel group that's located in /user/local/etc/sudoers. So it just everything runs with sudo for the wheel group. Make sure your user ID is part of the wheel group and video. You can do this during the install as mentioned above. Install X. I ran into a number of issues here. First, getting a seg fault when I tried to start X, and then X loading but with no keyboard support. Big thanks to @Ali and @DataDupe on the Dragonfly BSD IRC who gave me some crucial pointers to push through. Install Xorg, a desktop environment, and a display manager. So package install, Xorg, XFCE, and XDM. To get X started, you'll need to install and configure the appropriate display driver. PKG install, XF86 video, SCFB. Create the file /user/local/etc/x11/xorg/xorg.conf.d/driver-scfb.conf and add the following lines to it. And it's just got a bit of code there. You look at the show notes to get that code.
Yeah.
This got X working, but I couldn't use the keyboard. To rectify that, install and configure the EV dev drivers. Package install xf86-input-evdev and then echo kern.evdev.rcpt_mask=3 to sysctl.com. Enable XDM. So echo XDM equals yes out to rc.conf. Update from post this blog. XDN crashes on logout requiring a hard reset. I found that the Slim Display Manager works better. To install and enable Slim, sudo package install Slim, and then echo Slim enable equals yes out to ectrc.conf. I'll just interrupt there, but yeah, Slim is way better to use as a XDM display manager startup utility. That never seems to have an issue, but yeah, the XDM one does. Back to the blog. Add the following to /etc/rc.conf, dbus underscore enable equals yes, and halld enable equals yes. And finally, configure the home.xsession. So xsetb equals off, so you don't get an annoying beep, 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 beep. And then xmod map, dollar home, and then dot xmod map. And then exec start xfce 4, so it then just forks the XFCE startup process out. Now, on to a few more customizations here. Change the default shell to bash. So chsh, create .bashrc and bash profile for root and user. Reboot. Setting up the window manager. The default font in TWM and CTWM is very small. So let's make it bigger by adding the following lines to X default. And the font name is changed to monospace and the font size is changed to 13. If you're a Vim user, this is always a critical tweak. So in the xmod map file, swaps the caps lock with escape, remove lock equals caps lock, and key sim caps lock equals escape, and key sim escape equals caps lock, and add lock equals caps lock. Then add it to xsession. So it just xmods maps that out to xsession. It's all good to shut off that annoying beep. And then again, xsetb off to xsession. So now to get sound working. This is taken from another blog that he's linked to in his notes. Add the following lines to /boot/loader.conf and then that is SND HDA load equals yes and SND U audio load equals yes. Tuning for energy use. So add to etc/sysctl.conf and then change the ACPI state from the turning the lowest into C2 rather than C3 because C3 made the computer too slow. And then macdep mwait cx idle equals auto dep. And add the following to rc.conf, which is powerd enable equals yes. Outstanding issues. The touchpad. The biggest headache by far for me, which I have not been able to resolve getting working, is getting the touchpad working to my liking. I use the Acme editor, so the touchpad needs to either work very well or I'm turning it off. The touchpad on the ThinkPad T480S is LNTech. I was able to enable LNTech support, but it turned into a game of device driver whack-a-mole. Every time I got one feature working, something else stopped working. I eventually gave up and plugged in an Evolent 3-button mouse, which works quite nicely in the XFCE-DE. I'm going to take another shot at getting the trackpad working, focusing on the following. Decrease sensitivity, disable touchpad while typing, enable two-finger scrolling, and recognize all three physical buttons. Another outstanding issue is the mouse in a good enough situation. He added the following lines to rc.conf. So mouse D enable equals yes, mouse D type equals auto, mouse port equals /dev/psm0 and mouse D flags equals -V. Finally, other issues. Buttons on the top don't work except for mute, unmute. Laptop is a little slow after battery saving tweaks. I'm going to play with this a little bit more. Suspend, resume doesn't work, but that's an issue even in a lot of Linux distros. And then just finally, he's got some other to-dos. Get volume buttons working and adjust the black light. So there's a link there to the Dragonfly docs there. Sounds interesting.
And many of these configuration items can also be applied to other systems, like the shell and font settings. That is certainly applicable to other systems.
Yeah, they're pretty generic, especially when you move away from the standard base install and you're moving into XFCE and things like that. They're all generic across all the different BSDs, and a lot of the stuff that we just talked about there is applicable in FreeBSD as well. So.
Mm. News Roundup has us an entry for Ampere in the Wild, how FreeBSD employs Ampere ARM64 servers in the data center. So this is directly on amperecomputing.com and has been written by Ed Mast and Greg Wallace of the FreeBSD Foundation, and goes like the following. The FreeBSD Foundation and project rely on generous donations of time, equipment, and money to keep FreeBSD at the forefront of computing. In late 2020, Ampere donated 5 servers to the FreeBSD community. Thanks for that. And the FreeBSD Foundation purchased for the community another 2 in order to support development of FreeBSD. The servers are located in 365 Data Center's Bridgewater, New Jersey facility and are compatible with the ARM64 instruction set and optimized for users of large cloud platforms. Ampere is a cloud-native processor supplier for high-performance and native cloud computing, whose chips are widely known for the density, energy efficiency, and performance, making for an ideal configuration for FreeBSD, which is also known for many of the same attributes. These combined Ampere systems provide value to FreeBSD in 4 key areas. The first, package build machines. 3 of the Ampere systems in the Bridgewater 365 data center operate as a package build machine for FreeBSD. They provide all the ARM64 production packages that are available for FreeBSD 13, 14, and upcoming 15, and build 2 varieties of packages, latest and quarterly. The latest packages are built on an ongoing basis or rolling release. Essentially, this means that whenever there is a change to a port, a package blueprint, a new package is built. The latest packages are for users who prefer or acquire the latest software without delay. Quarterly packages are built from a snapshot of the ports tree taken at the beginning of each quarter. Those packages are for users who prefer to only update their packages once every few months. Security patches and updates are backported from latest packages versions to quarterly packages. This means that the security fix is taken from the most recent version of upstream software and then applied to an older version, in this case, the quarterly updated version. The second key area is security builds and tests. The fourth Ampere system in the Bridgewater data center is dedicated to the security team's use, specifically for building and testing security updates for all supported FreeBSD branches on ARM64. FreeBSD takes security seriously. Developers work continuously to harden the operating system. This in turn helps secure the work of other developers working on other projects. It's no secret that layered protections are required to protect against modern security threats. The FreeBSD security team works constantly to ensure that the operating system level is as tight a defense as possible. To make that happen, the FreeBSD security strategy focuses on 3 main areas and groups. First, Product Security Incident Response Team, or PSIRT, PSIRT field teams or field reports on security issues. It reports its end goal is to respond to by identifying the problem and providing a fix for discovered and reported security flaws. The second item, proactive security work. As opposed to incident response, proactive security work includes active searches for identifying security vulnerability mitigations and a general architectural security review. This team is a combination of security team members and domain-specific experts who also cover the random number generator and general design time security in FreeBSD. The third item, hardening the security of the FreeBSD infrastructure, including the FreeBSD website and source code repository and all of the services that FreeBSD runs. There are several groups that work on this aspect of security and consist of more than just security team members. Going back to the original 4 key areas, the next one is download servers. One of the best-known advantages of FreeBSD is its unequaled reliability and performance as an internet server. The 5th Ampere machine in the Bridgewater data center is running ftp0.freebsd.org, the primary distribution node for all image artifacts that FreeBSD produces. A modern FTP server has long since outgrown its moniker. To that end, most transfers from ftp0freebsd.org are over HTTP or HTTPS protocol. The purpose of these servers remain the same. However, files are transferred back and forth between servers and through the cloud. By simplifying and speeding distribution in this way, users can quickly and easily download and upload the files and images they need. And the last of the four key areas is running reference jails. FreeBSD provides reference platforms to the developer community to support porting and testing applications on architectures supported by FreeBSD. The 6th Ampere machine, soon to be joined by the 7th in the Bridgewater data center, provides reference jails for several versions of FreeBSD. FreeBSD port maintainers use these ARM64 servers for testing updates to their ports on ARM64. And in conclusion, they look a little bit into the future development. These servers also support development work to refine Beehive on ARM64 and high core count scalability. Note, by the time we're recording this, Andrew Turner has committed ARM64 Beehive support to FreeBSD's head. This is just, you know, this just in. Continuing with the statement here from Ampere Computing, this will be particularly useful to cloud service providers and hosting companies who want to provide multiple instance sizes to their customers, and to enterprise users who want to optimize hardware utilization by ensuring that workloads are given the resources they need and no more. In summary, the combination of Ampere native cloud processors on the latest server hardware boosts FreeBSD features and uses while also lending powerful potential and support to the FreeBSD community. Thank you, Ampere Computing.
Excellent. Yeah, I like your little tweak in there that you talked about the Beehive being committed for ARM64. We're talking about that before the show. And it's something that I'm probably going to go away and play with, because I've got to read the notes and see if it's actually going to work on Raspberry Pi SoCs, because I think, VMware, back when VMware was, you know, ESXi was good, sort of, it would run on that Raspberry Pi, and that's how a lot of testing was done. So it'll be interesting to see if we can get it. I don't think, when I spoke to Peter Green last, I don't know if those, the gear is inside the SoC of the Raspberry Pi. I think it's one revision behind. And so it'll be interesting to see if that comes up, but I'm sure that'll be in the release notes. But I've got a Raspberry Pi 400 floating around, because I got rid of my Raspberry Pi 4. So I think I'll pull the 400 out of the closet today, because I've got the day off from work. So
mm-hmm. That way. Yeah.
Yeah. So I might give it a bit of a squeeze and see what.
I mean, I will look forward to how-tos from people that will have this running on any kind of ARM64 servers, whether it's in Raspberry Pi or any other SoC. This will be exciting to see as a how-to, how people are running this.
Yeah, I think it's been one of those, you know, everybody's hanging out for it because, you know, ARM CPUs are so efficient, and being able to, you know, drive that efficiency even further into hypervisors is, you know, where it's going to be at and where the cost savings are. You know, you look at data center, you know, power usage, and I look at, you know, how much we use at work. To drive the x86
becomes money.
And if you can cut that down while not impacting application performance, then, you know, it's the sky's the limit for the architecture.
And the developers will also appreciate the testing from various platforms or devices that people have. And so this is also good for everyone to get the feedback, and that it's actually working, or where it's not working, how they can fix that.
Yep. So if you're a consumer of ARM hardware, now's the time to go and test the latest code that's been committed and in your ARM64 environment. Happy days. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Next item up is FreeBSD YubiKey authentication. So this is a GitHub gist that's over on GitHub. The links are in the show notes. This is a really, really long article.
It's so very detailed. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just going to cover the top notes of this article, and I highly recommend, you know, going and seeing the different caveats. So through this, it's got, you know, how to make it work with ESXi and all sorts of different platforms around that FreeBSD is involved with here. So the overview: how to configure FreeBSD and applicable applications to work with the YubiKey for authentication. This serves as my work in progress documentation of the configuration knobs needed to make this work properly. What's covered here is FreeBSD SSH with Priv Smart Card D slot on YubiKey, the PKCS 11 via libykcs11.so, FreeBSD SSH with FIDO support on YubiKey, FreeBSD Firefox Chrome with FIDO and WebAuthn support on YubiKey, FreeBSD local console and GDM authentication using PAM on YubiKey, and FreeBSD official YubiKey tools. So the tested versions are FreeBSD 13.2 testing August 2023, FreeBSD Stable 13 testing August 2023 with OpenSSH 9.3p2, and FreeBSD Stable 14 testing October 2023 with OpenSSH 9.5p1, OpenSSL 3.0.11, and libfido 2.1.13. It covers the YubiKey PIV slot names and numbers in the show notes, and then goes through the different parts of what you need to install and configure to get it up and running. So this one's not one that we're sort of going to relay over the communication channel of an audio podcast, because there's just so much content here. So highly recommend going back to the show notes and checking out the link and then deep diving further into it.
Yeah, use those YubiKeys to protect your messaging or even your commits. You can sign those with your individual key so that it's authentic and people know that it's from you. Okay, then we have a nice story that I found we definitely need to cover on the show. That time, I almost added Tetris to HTOP. And this is from the author, of course, and goes like the following. Confession time. Once I almost added a terminal version of Tetris as an Easter egg in HTOP. This is, if I look at the About page, Hisham H. Muhammad lives in Porto Alegre, Rio Grande do Sul, south of Brazil. So this is from the About page, so just that you know where this is coming from. And back to the article. So he managed to implement a real crude but working version of it, code golfing, to make it as short as possible and got it pretty tiny, then added it to the help screen so it would activate by typing HTOP. Oh, of course. Since H would take you to the help screen and the other keys would be knobs in that screen. Okay. Then there's the question of how to hide an Easter egg in a free and open source software code base. Best he could think of was to make it into a long one-liner starting at column 200 so that most people looking at the code without word wrapping editors would miss it. But after everything was coded, he decided that trying to sneak code in, even in my own code base, was a bad practice, and the good intention of innocent fun wasn't worth it. My fascination with Tetris goes way back. He first implemented it when he was in high school, and getting it done really gave him a pause. That was a real program, something that people paid real money in, Nintendo cartridges, for example. It was the first time he thought he could really call himself a programmer for real. At the same time, it was the first contact with the ethics of software. He had never heard of free and open source software before, and yet asked himself, what if my friends ask for the source code? What should I do? Years later, when they did the first CD version of our Gobo Linux distro, they took an existing ncurses version of Tetris and hacked it into their installer, adding a progress bar that showed the status of files copying from CD to disk while the user played the game. Distro installers took forever back then, yeah? Everyone loved it. Except for the fact that it was supposed to auto-quit when the installation was finished, but we changed the list of packages last minute so it got the count wrong. A lot of people just kept playing for a long time without realizing installation was done. But it wasn't too bad, they say. They would just press escape or something to quit and finish the install. Our early Gobo releases were full of little fun tweaks like that. In one release, we included an emulator, and legend has it that some hidden folder contains a ROM, not Tetris, but not even they remember what that is, and that the ISO probably isn't even online anymore. We really should have preserved our old stuff better. Okay, the memory of the Tetris installer in Gobo having last-minute bug was another thing that dispelled him from the idea of the Tetris Easter egg in HTOP. While having bugs is just normal, he couldn't bear the thought of HTOP having some serious bug caused by code added for silly reasons. HTOP has its fair share of unnecessary code, such as the big digit LCD meter and the themes, which are more artsy than utilitarian, and he stands by them. If anything, he thinks software in general should be more artsy. But hidden Tetris in HTOP causes buffer overflow would be a terrible problem report for the project, and his reputation by extension, he guesses. That, along with the bad taste in the mouth of the idea of hiding code in free and open source software, left them drop the Easter egg idea. They wish they still had that code, though, if only to keep it to himself as an autobiographical side note. Come to think of it, after writing all of this, they realized they probably should have included that code as a comment. Maybe that's the way to do Easter eggs in open source software. And they fun and silly features, but leave it commented out so that someone tinkering with the code finds it, enables it, and has fun with it for a bit. He thinks that they should have enjoyed finding something like that in a code base. Ah, well, maybe someday they'll pull this into some project. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I think it should be left as a comment in the code and let people play with it as they see fit. Then that way you don't have to worry about bugs because you're not going to trigger anything. So
maybe someone builds this into an installer in a BSD project.
BSD.
Well, the installers are so small. Oh, yeah, so
BSD install gets an update. What's the update? Oh, nothing.
I can't even remove a single line before the installer finishes.
Yeah, it's so fast these days, especially on NVMe.
Okay, that was the funny part about Tetris. And we have some little nuggets as well in the Beastie Bits this week, starting off with Mail Software Projects for You.
Yeah, this is a article over on Michael W. Lucas's blog. I'll read it in the words of Michael W. Lucas. I can't do his voice. So shame we don't have him here to do the read for us, but here goes. Working through the tale of Run Your Own Mail Server. It's a book he's writing at the moment, so highly suggest you go out and sponsor the project. I think sponsorships are ending soon, so you know, get out there while you can to get your name in the book. Has led to a couple of things that I'd like to see. Maybe some reader would like to hack on one of them for me. The best way to generate a list of hosts that should be bypassed, postfix, intrusive protocol checks, or anything that resembling gray listing is the PostWhite. PostWhite has been abandoned for years, though. It isn't exactly a problem. It's a feature, complete, and does the job. The configuration is clunky, though. It supports long obsolete lists of Yahoo mail addresses. Lists of domains it generates lists for is hard-coded in the script and is artificially broken up into categories like legit bulk mailers, social media, and so on. You should not have to edit the script to remove a domain because who accepts mail from LinkedIn these days? You shouldn't have to edit the script for anything. The last edit to this was 6 years ago, so I suspect it's basically abandoned. Moving the domains to an external file and dropping the defunct Yahoo page would be good. You have to fork it using a meaningful name like Grayskip or such. Some such would be nice. Number two. Postfix on FreeBSD supports BlacklistD. This is grand. Log passes are inherently fragile and libblacklists is the smart way for an application to declare that an IP address is misbehaving. The Postfix support only applies to authentication attempts on SMTPD. However, I'm in favor of that, but I'd also like to see PostScreen grow libblacklistD support. A host on a trusted DNSBL pokes our mail port, block it. I could do number one, but I lack the time and refuse to recommend my fault obvious code for production. I lack both skills and time for number two. The truth is, we've limped along like this for years. We could limp for many more years, but hey, someone out there might want to make the world suck slightly less.
Yeah, right? That would be appreciate it. And we continue with Michael's blog. He has another article written. At long last, the MWL title index is now part of his website top navigation bar. And here's the entry for it. I try to hold down the amount of information on this site. I truly do. I also try to keep the menus at the top no more than one layer deep. But finding individual titles on my website has become increasingly difficult. People complain that they can't find titles. Well, Michael Lucas has written a bunch of titles, so that's understandable. Everything is filed logically, but logic is limited. Is PAM Mastery a sysadmin tool or an operating system reference? Should Git Commit Murder be filed under crime novels or software crimes? So he maintains the official title list in his OID accessible to the world via a trivial SNMP query, because why not? That MIB doesn't have links, though. It never will. I'm not rewriting my OID if I need to reorganize my website. Here's the brand new comprehensive title index. And if you click on that, oh boy, that's a long list of books he has written. Tech books, short stories and novels, the Canadian version of ZFS Mastery, TTRPGs, it's all there. Sort by title or release date or length or genre, or you can find it all in a link to the book's entry. Most short stories that were released as standalones were pulled into collections, so those entries link to the collection. The point of the index is so that you can acquire a thing, whatever the thing is, or learn that the thing's utterly unavailable. This also served as a double check of his website. To his shock, everything he knows has an entry. He's saying, I'm not saying this is everything. I have no idea what I've forgotten, but what I know about, I have claimed. Why do this now? I had to hire help to accomplish it. No way I was dredging through all this crap. So it's definitely a big improvement and also a big achievement. Like, look at all these entries. A lot has been written from Lucas.
Did you see the comments?
Very impressive.
Dan Legel's been in there. He's gone. He's tried to do a walk through the MIB. Yeah.
The book table.
Unfortunately, he doesn't have the MIB table. So Michael has pointed him over to where to go and download the MIB file so he can have a bit of a walk himself.
Excellent. So yeah. Keep writing, Michael. We just are in awe of your continued, you know, artistically or authorship of great books in the fiction and nonfiction area.
And the final item for tonight is over on Slashdot. That's a blast from the past, that is. But anyway, on Slashdot, how does FreeBSD compare to Linux on the Raspberry Pi? Klaus Zimmermann, a self-described friendly hacker, recently posted a state of the distro post, choosing his favorite distributions for things like portable installation from a USB drive, Alpine Linux, and for a desktop OS, Debian Linux or Devoir. But when it comes to a distro for the Raspberry Pi, or at least until the 4, Zimmermann argues that FreeBSD performance is unlike any other Linux distribution I've ever seen, even with CPU power activated and overclocking. A quote from the post. Nope, no match. FreeBSD's performance on the Pi is still way better, even without overclocking. You can browse a modern web, can have things scroll smoothly, watch videos, and even play some 3D games like Quake with it. And if you overclock it a little to 2 GHz, you can even make it run the gargantuan MS Teams. But what about all that lackluster driver support? Wi-Fi drivers still on the 802.11g standard and all? Surely you can't be serious about it when Linux offers all that support out of the box, right? Wrong. Actually, for starters, the drivers provided for the Pi's hardware are often half-assed proprietary blobs. I no longer think FreeBSD is really at fault if the driver support for the hardware is not helpful to begin with. Even drivers you find for Linux are shaky at best. So yes, I will keep using FreeBSD on the Pi as a desktop with USB Wi-Fi and audio adapters for those services, because the existing hardware is sort of moot even otherwise. And with those USB adapters and FreeBSD, the Pi works really well. Truly desktop-like. I'd be curious to hear from Slashdot readers about their own experience. with Linux and FreeBSD on the Raspberry Pi. Zimmerman's final winner for the server category was Debian, though of his two servers, one is just an XMPP server set up on the Raspberry Pi. I found, in quotes, I found that using Debian on the Pi is a really joy. Easy and simple to set up, familiar environment and all, so I'm keeping it. This concept is about to be overshadowed, however, by my growing like of FreeBSD lately.
Yeah, briefly skipped some of the comments. These are the typical comments you read on the web about if there is a comparison between operating systems. And yeah, it goes down into not a shiny world or a shiny environment.
Nobody
where you want to be.
No one lets their friends read the comments on Slashdot.
Yeah. Move on. Nothing to see here. Yeah. These aren't the comments you're looking for. And so, yeah, it's individuals' decision what they run and their own individual experiences, which typically differ from other people's.
Yeah, I'd have to say that Raspberry Pi 400, when I was playing around with that a couple of years ago with FreeBSD and Linux and comparing the two, FreeBSD did run on that piece of hardware a lot better than the Linuxes. Granted, there were certain things that hadn't been ported to FreeBSD, so, you know, some hardware acceleration, that sort of stuff was missing. But overall, if you were using that Raspberry Pi 4 as like a desktop replacement, FreeBSD was the pick of the bunch on that.
And it's also, I heard some of the developers talking that the Raspberry Pis weren't as good as they used to be in terms of providing documentation for all these embedded drivers or the embedded hardware. So it's difficult or became more difficult to develop drivers for these new Raspberries. I'm not sure if that's still the case today, but this is a big issue in the embedded world. If you don't have documentation and you just have to make guesses, and typically this is not how it's internally wired. And that way, without documentation, the drivers or the software compatibility is only as good as it can get. Okay, and this brings us into a section of the episode, which would normally be feedback and questions. We didn't get much that we could cover, so please give us something to feedback@bsdnow.tv that we can answer to, maybe a question that you always wanted to know or something that is odd. Maybe you have a problem with any of the BSDs, we can try to help you. Or if you found a good blog post, a show idea, or a topic that you want to cover, this is where you could go. feedback@bsdnow.tv. We also have a BSD Now Telegram channel, which is t.me/bsdnow, where people keep joining and there's lively discussions going on, but not all the time. So it's also has its quiet periods. And so this is kind of a nice way of talking to other BSD listeners.
And if you don't want to send feedback into the mail box, then you can just post the links in the Telegram channel. We're all in the Telegram channel, so we'll look at those links and check them out and add them to the show if they're applicable.
Yeah.
BSD Now is sponsored by Tarsnap. Everyone needs backups, and Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud, so that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what data is duplicated so that bandwidth can be saved. It then assembles your data into compressed blocks, encrypts them with your local private key that never leaves your system, and then uploads those encrypted blocks to the cloud. So even if someone is able to obtain your backed up data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code to make sure that it does what we say it does. Tarsnap also does bug bounties if you find errors in the code. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse to not have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more.
And if you want to support the show, the work that we're doing, or give us new microphones if they break one day, hopefully they will last a while. We have also a Patreon channel. It's patreon.com/BSDnow. You can find different donor levels there. And then you can say, ah, well, Benedict should have at least one coffee per day, the old tea drinker that I am. or anything is definitely appreciated. You don't have to give, but anything, if you can spend a dime or two, that's certainly appreciated, especially for JT, who's doing all the hard work behind the scenes, doing the post-production, the creation of the show notes with us, and a whole load of work is done after we stop.
Yeah, he certainly does a significant amount of workload to bring these shows to you. Because the amount of errors that we make when we're recording and things like that, you know, he's got to listen to everything, you know, multiple times. So he spends quite a significant amount of hours editing these for us.
I wonder if he has nightmares with our voices in them. I'm not sure if these are things you want to have in your ears all day. But that's what he chose to do, and he's doing good work there. So that's one way of appreciating that a little bit with giving us some money this way. All right, then we thank you for listening. Hopefully you will have a nice week until you hear us next time in your podcatcher next week. Same time, roughly same day. We'll see. And have a good time till then.